couple of promotional ideas. Today we're going to talk about the Gentiles, God of the Nations by Henry Morris. It's probably the best I know of. There may be others. And I wish he'd go a little deeper, but he does scratch on some of the things we're going to talk about today. And so that's a good book on the Gentiles. We're going to do, by the way, a lesson on the Gentiles, the Jews, the Gentiles in the church. So we're going to focus on the Gentiles today. And then over the years, I have been writing papers. And so what I'm going to do from time to time, and I'm going to make available to you, one, it's called Revelation 20:11 and 21, one passages, a corrected chronology of Revelation 18 and 21. These are the subjects I've been talking about recently. So it's only a few pages long. You could probably sit down and read it in 20 minutes. Anyway, if you want one of these, just come up in front, write your name on that little sheet there, and then I'll have it for you next week. I'll have a name on it so you can pick it up. Or if any time during the time you think you'd like to have it, ask me for it. I have others I'll make available, but I don't want to go too fast, overwhelm you, or underwhelm me. Like I said, this is an introduction about the Gentiles, because Gentile judgments occur in Isaiah 13 to 23. That section is going to be the judgment of the nations. I don't know how I'm going to deal with that yet, but I want to make sure that we understand that the Gentiles have a place in God's economy, in his, I must say, in his kingdom even, as it will develop in the after the second coming. So my boilerplate kind of change it a little bit every week. So our last study, the Bible as a contract, we finished the newly created heavens and the earth found in Revelation 21:1. And by the way, we have not really talked much about the kingdom yet, and I've talked to alluders that we need to do just a detailed study about the kingdom, the implications of some of the things that are in the kingdom. We just pass over and move on. But so we've got to do that yet someplace. So we have made the observation that it mirrors, Revelation 21:1, mirrors the book-ending chapters of Isaiah 66, 65 and 66 in 2 Peter 3, making the new heavens and the earth event for the kingdom, not after 1,000 years of it. And by the way, that's kind of what's argued in that paper. If the earth, and our question is, if this isn't true, then the earth has to be so bad or so damaged, it must be destroyed. And if destroyed, I have to ask the question, why would God destroy something he has created? Not a very good answer to that yet. So, I have my answer. It has been noted that Isaiah is the apocalypse, the destruction of the world, is what apocalypse means of the Old Testament, as Revelation is the destruction of the world in the New Testament. So my conclusion is that there is no new world, quote, quote, there are some changes probably, but not in the concept of the new world, beyond the 1,000-year mark of the kingdom revealed either in the Old or New Testaments. Now our intention is to investigate the hypothesis of our study in Isaiah, since it's one of those parallel books to Revelation. It is a Jewish book with a Jewish promise, with Jewish promises made with the Jewish ending. And our understanding is that the New Testament cannot deny any prophecies of the Old, nor does it add unless it specifically says that it has been added. And we know a couple of instances where it says this was before a mystery. Now it's been made known to you. Other than that, everything is in the Old Testament, probably not developed, but the ideas, the features of it do not change. So the last section we just finished up to chapter 12 was largely a historical one of the impending wars with Israel and Syria and Assyria. And behind that is the background, it becomes the background of the Messianic hope. It warns about the near wars, but it also extends the Messianic hope in the far distant future. Of course, they didn't know it's far distant future then. Now, chapters 13, 23, a large section, think about how many chapters, 11 chapters, is regarding the nations, or we call them the Gentiles. By the way, it's the same word. We just translate nation or Gentiles. And we're going to look at those that are around Israel, and we're not going to look at others that no doubt exist. So if they don't affect Israel, they're probably not going to be in the conversation. Selecting and preparing the kingdom occupants, we already know Israel's going to be in there. Now, well, how about the Gentiles? Are they, in fact, in there? Is it all about the Jews? It may be a valid charge that dispensationalists spend all their time studying Israel, and I've heard that, and her eschatology, and ignore what is being said about the rest of the people, the Gentiles. After all, we are Gentiles. Of course, just dispensationalists study the church extensively, so we see ourselves identified with the church. So we know well about the Jews, we know about the church, and the Gentile section, oh well, sort of gets passed over. Well, we're going to spend a little bit of time today, and we're going to have to, next few weeks, talking about the Gentiles. So we have the opportunity as in Isaiah to correct that oversight, so to speak. We need to review Genesis chapter 4 through 12. I picked 10 of that section, early part of chapter 12. The history of the Gentiles is to set the stage for this study. And we did this as the preamble to the Bible as Contract series. Now, this will be a review for you if you were around 2 years ago. And if you've seen this all new to you, you might check with your doctor. So the sin of Adam and Eve in the garden changed life for themselves and everything they encountered. Is that true? Yes, it is. And their descendants of the first couple inherited the sin nature and the God-cursed earth as their habitat. Yes, they live in the same dirty water. Of the 6,000 years, approximately since our time, since creation, the first of those 6,000 years, the first 2,000 of those years, that is one-third of those 2,000 years of human history, was given over to the Gentile population to achieve righteousness. Now think about that. One-third of existence of humanity has been given over to the Gentiles to establish righteousness. Now remember, they lost it, so, you know, we'll talk a little more about this. So we have a lot of period of time, long period of time, with the Gentiles really prominent because there are no Jews in the first, let's say, 2,000 years, more or less. There's no Jews until Abraham, and he's not called a Jew until we get to Judah, his grandson. Then we get Jews from Judah because he's a dominant tribe. But there are no Jews unless you want to backpedal it, the word. So in the 2,000-year period, there were two segments where God remained disengaged. Now, you know what I mean, disengaged. I don't mean that he is a theist here, but that he really didn't manage the affairs on earth to direct it. It was allowing man to correct his fallen state. Now, that's important because there is this big argument going on. Well, is man really as bad off as he could be, or is there some good in him? Give him a proper chance, he will certainly find his way home. So God gives them this chance to find his way home. However, after 1,600 years approximately, humanity, rather than getting better, gets worse. So bad that it was, as the Bible said, every thought and deed was evil, and continually so, and the population was self-destructing, and God had actually destructed it with the flood judgment, but he did preserve a seed. Now, as I think about the judgment in those days, the intention of Satan in those days to destroy the world, I see that still going on today. You know, and this is a good exercise for you politically. It says, is there anything that the left is proposing today that will not end in the absolute destruction of the world? And when I'm saying destruction of the world, is it possible that there will not be one man, woman, or child left after they're done? That's possible. You know, the population of the world right now is declining. And what is the left telling us? We've got too many people in the world. We've got to minimize the population. We can't feed them all. So while they're trying to minimize the population destroying itself. And like in Russia, if there is no influx of people into Russia, they will die out. You get below 1.8 birth rate, you cannot recover. It doesn't matter how long it takes. So I'm thinking we're looking at all kinds of things and pick any, whether it's global warming or fossil fuel, you know, don't use those. We've got to go back to the old days. Any of those issues you can pick up and run them to their end, you'll find that mankind dies out. And so that's what Satan wants. So there's been a direct attempt, and now there's some of these more subtle attempts that are still happening. Interesting that things really haven't changed much. Well, then after the flood event, and I'm going to use, like I've mentioned to you before, John Pilkey, I'm going to use his dating because if you use somebody's dating in one place, somebody else dating someone else, it makes no sense. I'm going to use his dating throughout, and it may be right, it may be wrong, but at least he has one consistent date. So he has a flood date a little bit earlier than most do, maybe 100 years earlier which is good because there's always a problem to get enough years in between the Tower of Babel and Abraham and all this kind of stuff. So this adds another year. He's not doing that for that reason, but I'm just saying his dating gives better spacing in there, which is one of the big arguments that some of the people have, that we have to say there's generational gaps. Well, if you get the dating right, you don't need the generation gaps. So, okay, here we go. Then after the flood event, let's say 2518, God allowed man to try again with a righteous man named Noah and self-governance. We call it government. But again, that experiment failed. So Adam failed, so Noah failed. And we say that failing now for Noah is at 2398 when he cursed Canaan and it came out of his naked experience with his boys. You know, that was a big event. The Bible sort of goes over it. I mean, we think it goes, well, it's just one of those bad days for Noah. No, it changed human history because the conflicts that came out of Noah's family is traceable back to this event. So Adam failed. Now Noah has failed. Now he didn't fail with the repopulating of the earth. So the repopulating of the earth by families, they became warring factions. And the Tower of Babel exasperated that because we have now man trying to stand up and compete with God. That's how brave they were. So that incident was an open rebellion in this period. It's not another chance, so to speak. There was no third chance given here. The unity experiment certainly was ended with that, if not sooner. However, the earth was to be populated, and it was populated by, let's say, 2150. Now, that is about the time Abraham shows up. It's a little bit after Abraham gets promised. So by the time 2150 goes, we have the earth is populated in the sense that there's settlements in all hemispheres of the world, including the Americas. And this explains a lot of these things we see in Americas, like the mounds east of St. Louis and the Incas, the hills that we have down in Mexico and other places. There's always these pyramids that look like that come out of Egypt, and we never can explain them. Well, it's because these are the families of Noah, and they have come to settle, and they made the same mark here as they left in Egypt, because they are built by the grandchildren of Noah, not by names of we don't know. Okay, so there's no third chance with the Tower of Babel. However, the earth was populated by, let's say, 2150, as per God's instruction to Noah. So Noah did accomplish God's mandate to repopulate the earth in spite of the oceans. This explains the antiquities found in America. I said that. Migration did not come by the Bering Strait. Doesn't mean that no one ever came across that, but in terms of Noah's population, did not come across Bering Strait. They came across more from Spain, what we call Spain or Portugal, and into what's now Brazil. That's the shortest distance on the Atlantic. And these dates are given by John Pilkey. If you're interested to break your brain out on that stuff, you can. Well, the last war, this might be very controversial, but think about this. It really, a lot of this stuff is circumstantial evidence. And circumstantial evidence can be very, very powerful. It can be very, very wrong. So this is probably circumstantial as far as we're concerned, but it fits very well. The last war in Genesis chapter 14 is after 2151. Abraham is in the land. Remember, they took Lot and Abraham went after him. This happens after Abraham leaves Haran. The war was the last attempt to establish the global unity by war by subduing Abraham's challenge. There were nations that attacked. There were four and five got together and they attacked Abraham. And Abraham, with his small troop, wipes them out or challenges them. And that takes care of that. This guy's name is Cheddar, king of Elam, which is probably Japheth, of Joah's son. Now, he said, wow, that's unbelievable. Well, this is really kind of interesting stuff. So don't let it stumble you, but it's probably what it is. Now, one of the other southern four kings were probably Ham, so we have all three boys in proximity to each other at the end of this war. Now, this is very important because something is happening here. Now, Shem was not in the war, remember, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem was not in the war, but he's in Jerusalem, just in the stone's throw from where Abraham is and the place where God promised Abraham land. So the time for global unity has passed and impossible. And the war showed that, because that war was the last attempt to try to establish some kind of unity, national unity of human race. But again, global unity is being promoted by Satan as a solution to man's problem. And it always is a wrong solution. So we know the story of Abraham, Genesis 14. After the battle, he goes to Jerusalem, to meet with the remaining son of Noah. I no doubt here in my mind, it's Melchizedek. Circumstantial evidence is overwhelming. If not here, where in the world is Shem? Now, let's answer that question. And Shem just drops out and is gone? I mean, he is the key personality out of the Noahic flood. And he disappears, never to be seen again. It makes absolutely no sense. But it makes total sense if he shows up in Jerusalem in the place of Salem of peace, representing God, and that's what he does there. And Abraham goes and pays respects to him because he is a descendant of Shem. And now Shem actually passes on the mandate, I call it the baton. Said, by now God has promised Abraham a blessing of the land, a family of believers, before 2150. The meeting with Melchizedek was like passing the baton for a new lap, a new divine order. Not going to depend on man anymore. So in contract language, we have Genesis 1 through 11. Let's include all the chapters there. Whereas God has allowed man to give it his best shot to be righteous. But after two failures, a third attempt would be futile. So God changes his tactics. And that's where we go into the contract. So God returns to take personal charge of the plan for righteousness using one man and his wife. And for this, God chooses Abraham and Sarah. I'm going to use their old names. A descendant of Shem, Abram appears before Melchizedek as Melchizedek is as his superior. Melchizedek is much older than Abraham. But I think he still outlives Abraham. I think that's how it goes. All right, so this attempt like Adam or Noah? This with Abraham. Is this attempt like Adam and Noah another one-man-based experiment? Well, yes, it's a one-man-based experience, but it's no. In fact, that it's different. This time, God is with one man, Abraham. It's like power steering. I mean, he is the hand in the glove. God will take 100% responsibility for the execution of righteousness. And I put capital R's on my righteousness because I'm talking about absolute righteousness here, not relative righteousness. You know, the righteousness that only God has. The God-forced plan is fail-proof by making the Abrahamic promise unconditional. Contrast, Adam and Noah could and did fail. Abraham will stumble but cannot fail. Very important point for you guys that are covenantally leaning. They always want to have God change his mind about all this stuff. Well, Noah's family planted settlements around the globe as he faithfully fulfilled his mandate to repopulate it by 2150. And here I cite his work, if you're really interested in John Pilkey's work, Kingship at its Source. This is taken from the chronology. It starts on page 381, and it gives all the details. And it's good stuff. It's just very, very difficult to read because they're not acquainted with the vocabulary, and he is sourcing a lot of archaeological records that we can't read and don't understand, and they have names that have been changed. So anyway, he does that, and he does it from a dispensational point of view. That's why I trust him. He used to be at Master's College in California. I think he's still living, but he has moved on, not able to do this work anymore, and somebody else is picking it up for him, so we'll see how that goes. And by the way, this stuff's online if you want to look it up. The nations that are near the promised land are at times friendly to Israel and at times enemies to Abraham's family. Well, Adam and others were lights for God. Adam and others were lights for God in a dark world. God has lights always. There's always a witness, a testimony. We have Noah, and we have Melchizedek, and we have Lamech, and all these, Lamech, I think he's in that list, are also lights here, and they were dark in a very dark world. But righteousness was not realized as normal. Rather, distrust, intrigue, and wars resulted in this period, these both periods, actually. So Noah's seed repopulated the earth that had been destroyed, but in Noah's failure, there was no second destruction. Yet, for righteousness, a new way was needed. An independent man could not be dependent on to generate righteousness. I call it dead on arrival. Try it again. So as God steps in to guarantee a righteous family, the Jews, to represent his light on earth, questions rise. He's going to pick one. What happens to the rest? Are the souls of the Gentiles then not important? Or is this just for the Jews? The Gentiles do not disappear. After all, here we sit. Do they have a future? Well, yes, they do. Does the covenant provide for it? Yes, it does. It says, and thee, and families of the nations shall be blessed. So there is a small throwaway phrase that has an awful lot of meaning in it. And we depend more than the throwaway phrase for that meaning. But what role do they have, the Gentiles? This is the question to be answered in our study of Isaiah. Now, the Gentiles are included in the evangelism efforts of Israel. Gentiles, even back in the days when Israel was prominent, the Gentiles were included in the evangelism efforts of Israel. Now, they did not go out as missionaries. But there's another way of doing this, God says. And the way that God says, I want you to do this, I want you to live an exemplary life, that you will be like a flame that will attract all these moths, and they will come to your light and be saved. Well, what happened? You know the story. Israel didn't live up faithfully to be an attractive light. They were like all the other nations, and they start taking idols to themselves. They weren't really different at all. So they failed in that sense, but that's a different issue. So the way this happens develops in the life of Israel as a nation, or didn't happen. But the light, it is God's plan that his chosen nation be that light. It is that nation that has his favor, that is to lift the torch of righteousness. And we have Matthew 5:14, it's like the city that's set on a hill. That was Israel. Israel did not go into the world. So there's an expectation that people should come to the light. That was all the Old Testament evangelism program. They have to come to the light. But the light has to be consistent for it to work. So we have God's intention for this expressed many times in the literature of the prophets. In other words, our faithful book, Isaiah 55:6, and that all men, includes Gentiles, may know from the rising of the setting and the setting of the sun that there is no one besides me. I am the Lord. There is no other. Malachi 1:11, almost a reflection of the words. For from the rising of the sun, even to the setting, my name will be great among the nations, and in every place incense is going to be offered to my name, and grain offering that is pure, for my name will be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. Now we know for sure that for this to occur, we're going to have to be in the kingdom. But the light is still available till then. So we might get the impression that Gentiles are a thorn in the side of Israel, but that's not always accurate. There are times when the Gentiles are helpful to Israel, and other times the same Gentiles are making life difficult for Israel. And we'll see in Isaiah the Gentiles are used to discipline Israel. So we have this, who are they anyway, these Gentiles? Well, in terms of contrast, think of Egypt. It is one of the favored nations in the Bible. You know, I think it called some my beloved or something like that. Not Israel, Egypt. Think of Egypt harboring Jacob's family in famine. Is that a good thing? Yeah, very good thing. They fed him. They put him up. They didn't kick him out. And that lasted for a while. And then a new king rose in Egypt, says in Exodus chapter 1, enslaving them. Now, is that a good thing?
No.
Well. Yeah, well.
No.
Yeah, right.
Picture,
well,
yes.
It was a good thing. It was
ask
a good thing.
When they're slaves and being whipped, ask them if it's a good idea.
Well, I don't like that. They don't want the lip. But what happened in their enslavement?
Isolation,
stay together. Right. They built a nation. Thank you. See, so we may see something negative, you know, in our life. Let's jump to application. We may see something negative in our life, but God's using it for something good. I think Romans 8:28 says something like that. It just seems to me like I remember saying that. So think of Egypt as a contrast, harboring Jacob's family in the famine. Then a few years, the king rules, and Egypt did not know Joseph, enslaves them. But that slaving is not a bad thing, because Egypt was useful in allowing Israel to grow to nationhood within their borders as slaves. Now, this is not a negative, although it may have seemed to them, but it was essential, because how else are you going to keep them pieced together until you make an underclass group, and the underclass cannot escape its identity. Here we go, identity crisis, people. So it's not a bad thing to be in God's place in a negative situation if it's his will. So Abraham and Abimelech had good relationships. He's an Egyptian guy, even though he tried to marry his wife, but whatever, that aside. Joseph and Mary fled to Egypt, what? To save their son. Was Egypt good then? Yes. Does God keep track of this kind of stuff? It certainly does. However, the blessing given to Gentiles is not the focus of scriptures from Genesis 12 on. Yet, from 586 B.C. to the end of the tribulation, this whole period of time, and we're still sitting it, is called the times of the Gentiles. All right, we're getting to the point here. The Gentiles have a significant spot. In the end, the Gentiles' functions are preserved, are rewarded, are made part of the kingdom. Now get this, even if they serve Israel in the kingdom, and remember, it's better to be a dormouse in the kingdom than being a king in hell. So we say, well, those poor guys, here we go, politically correct speech again, victimhood. Well, these poor Gentiles, they got to serve Israel for eternity. Well, that's too bad. No, they're in heaven glorifying the Lord and praising him for what he has done for them. So we have this idea that everybody's got to be the same status. That's not the way God does anything. There's always a difference, and it's based on responsibility and based on, to some extent, God's choice. Why are you sitting here saved and the guy down the street from you isn't? God's grace. So don't blame the guy sitting there, although you could. All right, we're still introduction. In fact, this whole lesson is introduction. Remember, I said it was introduction. So we know the Gentiles are in the kingdom, flat. They get there by two identities. First of all, the church is a mix of the Jew and the Gentile. So here we said, probably anybody here that claims to be Jewish. I mean, it's amazing. You know, Jenna's Jewish. We have Marilyn Rue is Jewish. You know, the pastor's wives in our church are always Jewish. You know that. So by that standard, Greg is Jewish. Cheryl is Jewish. That's their standard. I'm not sure how God keeps track of that, frankly. But the way the Jews keep track of it, they would be considered Jews. They could go immigrate to Israel and be shot at. They're not being shot at today. In fact, that's probably a good place to be is right now is in Israel. Okay, we know the Gentiles are in the kingdom. They get there by two identities. First of all, the church is a mix of all people, Jews and Gentiles, and that we sit here and we have Jews and Gentiles in our church today. But we are the church. That's an identity where Gentiles can go. In fact, they're mostly Gentiles in the church. Now, do you maintain the Gentile identification? I think to some extent, like the Jews maintain the identification in the church. I mean, I don't become Jewish when I become a part of the church. I'm a Gentile in the church. And the church is made up of Jews and Gentiles. So I don't lose my identity. Now, the raw, called before there's anything else, the raw Gentiles, those who predated Israel, predated Abraham, and the Gentiles who post-date, after the church, after the rapture, those Gentiles in the tribulation, those who do not die are in natural body. That's also another classification of Gentiles. So all these Old Testament, we call them pre-Abraham Gentiles. We skip through the period of the Jews into the tribulation. Now these Jews, Gentiles show up again as individual nations. The church is gone, so we can't have any church in this period. But we do have Gentiles and Jews now again. Now the Gentiles on earth, if they survive the tribulation, do not have glorified bodies. I'm going to say this in a minute just to keep it straight. Those that die in the tribulation that are Gentiles will get glorified bodies at the resurrection at the end of the tribulation. So, I mean, there are a lot of moving parts that keep track of all of this. So those that are living natural bodies do not die in the tribulation. Gentiles will go into the kingdom, and they are the Gentiles in the kingdom. I'll say this later. To get into the kingdom, you got to pass through the tribulation as a Gentile. You can't skip over it. Just think about that. You can't skip over it. Okay. Now, question, do the nations in the church age have a promise? In other words, we all sit here, probably everybody came from America. Does America, because we're not there anymore, does it have separate promises apart from us? I'm not sure. I got to think about this a little bit, and I have done some of that in the past, but didn't have time this weekend to really think a lot about it because it probably get me into too much trouble. So just leave it alone. But the question still is, do nations in the church age who are not saved, individuals, Gentiles that are not saved in the church age, do they have a promise as Gentiles? I think they must somehow have a promise. But they got to survive the rapture first. If they die out before the rapture, who's going to carry their blood into the tribulation? So we have the Hittites, they died out early. I mean, others that I'm trying to figure out, other nations that have died out already, they won't be in the tribulation, therefore they won't be in the kingdom. Think about it. So it is only the tribulation that the nations, from the tribulation that the nations are selected. You don't skip over and go to the Hittites, because who would be the blood of the Hittites? And it's something they've been shut off, so I think they're probably, some of the nations are condemned never to be in the kingdom. And that's kind of a study in these next 13 chapters. Are there any nations here that don't even have a future because God has disciplined them so severely that there is no hope for them to be in the kingdom? Are there such nations that we will see or not? I don't know. That's why we're doing this study, so I can be educated. It would appear that America is going to be here when the rapture occurs. Now, if that would not be the case, then you know, I've got to use a different example. But we're assuming that America is going to be here because we think the rapture is close by. America, the Gentiles, is not going to go away. There's just too many people. You know, what, 200? How many million people are there in America? 300?
You just pointed out the church is taken care of.
The church is taken care of, but leave Gentiles on earth. Yeah. Do they have a promise to get into the kingdom? All right. I did deal with this one of those times. I said there's something like, they get into the kingdom on the basis of how faithful they are and how they treated the Jews in the tribulation. Now, if they treated them very well, then they have a higher proportion of people in the kingdom. If you did not well, you'd have a lower number of people in the kingdom representing that family. That's a little conjecture, but you get to a point you have to conject a little bit, right?
Well, won't you have to be born again to go?
Yeah, absolutely. They got to be born again to get in the kingdom, right? Absolutely. Okay, so that rules out the Hittites and other nations that have been cursed to oblivion. So we won't expect to see any Hittites in the kingdom. But yeah, they end up being born again. All right, so we have Revelation. Now we're in the middle of the Revelation, in the middle of the tribulation, Revelation 5:9, and we have this song going on in heaven, and I'm asking the question, who are singing here? Worthy are you to take the book and break its seals, for you were slain, Lord, and you purchased for God with your own blood men from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. So now who are these people that are represented by from every tribe, tongue, and nation? Are we looking here now just at tribulation people? Or are we looking at a broad horizon for every nation and every person, every family that ever existed? Is that the scope of it? I just think we have to probably limit this to the tribulation population, because that would knock my idea out of what the Hittites did will have to be represented there. But how do they get there? We don't even know who they are. And I know God keeps track of who all these people are. I know that. But still, there's no identification of the Hittites once they die out. I think Amorites, some of these other ones, Ammonites, others have died. I'll try to look for list of names from Morse's book, who have already died out. And I wasn't satisfied with what he said. Yeah, Mike. They're there, no doubt. I don't know. So I don't know. There's all kinds of theories about election. There are people that, and I don't know. I don't know that I'm going to subscribe to any of these. But you know, some say that, well, if the parents are elected, therefore the children are elected, and the children of those that are not elected are not saved. I don't know. I'd rather go, let's let God save all of them and deal with what happens to them. Yeah, I think that's the best way, because God is not revealing it to us because we have nothing to do about it, and therefore stick your nose out of that question, Mike. But we all ask the question. I understand it. So I always am really, really happy when I come to a point when I said, I don't know. Because then I don't have to do anything anymore. Because I've run to the end of my argument. It doesn't matter. Okay. So Revelation 9, 5, 9. Now, they sang a new song. Worthy are you to take the book and break its seals. We're in the tribulation, breaking the seals. For you were slain. This is the early part of the tribulation already. And you purchased for God with your own blood men from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. Some of these are going to be resurrected, because I do think that these are martyred already in the early part of the tribulation. So the question is, every tongue, every tribe in the tribulation population, or is it broader? I think it's going to be have to be a tribulation population. And by the way, we've seen no resurrection yet, because the resurrection of the church is behind us, and the resurrection of the Old Testament saints, which includes the tribulation saints, is yet future at the end of it when the Lord comes. Let's see what I got here. Okay, in the tribulation, after the church is raptured, Revelation 14, 6 says, on earth, this is the evangelism going on now. John, pay attention. And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having the eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, to every nation, Gentiles and Jews, and tribe and tongue and people. So in the tribulation, we have a vast group of Gentile families besides Jews. So the target for this preaching is going on is Jews and Gentiles. But they're in the tribulation. Can't preach to the Hittites anymore. They're gone since the church has already been gathered. Where's a good spot? Maybe we'll stop right there. That'd be a good place. Because my next section here, I'll decide what I'm going to do next week. Because some of the stuff's kind of important to do, but it's still preliminary to our Isaiah chapter. Okay, thanks for participation. Anything else you want to say before I say goodbye?